The Marching Season, Disc 10.
They call themselves the Society for International Development and Cooperation, Delaroche began. They're a bunch of intelligence officers, businessmen, arms merchants, and criminals who try to influence world events in order to make money and protect their own interests. I don't believe such an organization really exists. They shot down the jetliner so that one of their members, an American defense contractor named Mitchell Elliott, could convince President Beckwith to build an anti-missile defense system. Michael had suspected that Elliott was involved in this tragedy. Indeed, he had put his suspicions in writing in his report to the agency. Still, to hear Delaroche confirm his suspicions made him feel nauseated. Sweat began running over his ribs. They knew you were getting too close to the truth, Delaroche said. They decided it would be best if you were dead, so they hired me to kill you. How did they know about my suspicions? They have a source inside Langley. What happened after Shelter Island? Michael asked.
I went to work exclusively for the Society.
Does the Society have a leader?
He's called the Director. He goes by no other name. He's an Englishman. He has a young girl named Daphne. That's all I know about him.
You were the one who killed Ahmed Hussein in Cairo. Delaroche turned suddenly and glared at Michael. The Society carried out the assassination at the behest of the Mossad. How did you know it was me?
Hussein was under Egyptian surveillance. I saw a videotape of the killing and noticed the wound on the assassin's right hand. That's when I knew you were alive and working again. That's when we issued the Interpol alert.
We knew about the alert immediately, Delaroche said, staring at the back of his right hand.
The Director has excellent contacts within the Western Intelligence and Security Services, but he said the information on the Interpol alert came from his source at Langley.
Why did the Society get involved in Northern Ireland?
Because it thought the peace agreement in Northern Ireland was bad for business. There was a meeting of the Society's Executive Council last month in Mykonos. The Society decided at that meeting to kill your father-in-law and you, and I was given the assignment.
Was the woman in the Volvo Rebecca Wells?
Yes. Where is she now?
That wasn't part of our deal, Michael.
Why kill me? The Director has invested a great deal of money in me, and he wanted to protect his investment. He saw you as a threat.
Was the source from Langley at the meeting on Mykonos?
Everyone was on Mykonos.
It was after 5 a.m. when Michael and Delaroche arrived in the village of Greenport on Long Island. They drove through the deserted streets and parked at the ferry landing. The boat lay quietly in its slip. It would not make its first trip across the Sound to Shelter Island for another hour. Michael used the public telephone next to the small clapboard shack at the terminal.
"Where the fuck are you?" Adrian Carter said. "Everyone in town is looking for you."
"Call me back at this number from a public phone."
The 10-digit number he recited to Carter bore no resemblance to the actual number for the public phone. He had given Carter the number in a crude code the two men had used in the field 100 years ago. Backward, the first digit one more than the real number, the second digit two less, the third digit three more, and so on. He did not have to repeat the number. Carter, like Michael, was cursed with a perfect memory. Michael hung up and smoked a cigarette while he waited for Carter to dress, get in his car, and drive to a public phone. The image of Carter pulling a coat over his pajamas made Michael smile. The telephone rang 5 minutes later.
"Would you mind telling me what the hell is going on?"
"I'll tell you when you get here."
"Where are you?"
"Shelter Island."
"What the hell are you doing there? Were you involved in that shootout on the Key Bridge?"
"Just get up here on the first plane, Adrian. I need you."
Carter hesitated a moment.
"I'll be there as soon as I can. But why do I know that this is going to suck?"
When Michael went back to the car, Delaroche was gone. He found him a moment later, leaning against a rusting chain-link fence, staring across the Sound toward the low, dark silhouette of Shelter Island.
"Tell me your plans,"
Delaroche said. If you want your money and your freedom, you're going to have to sing for your supper.
What do you want me to do?
Help me destroy the source inside Langley.
Do you know who he is?
I do, Michael said. And it's not a he. It's Monica Tyler.
I don't know enough to destroy Monica Tyler.
Yes, you do. Delaroche was still staring at the black water. Surely we could have done this somewhere but here, Michael. Why did you bring me back to this place? But Delaroche wasn't really expecting an answer, and Michael didn't give him one.
I need to know one thing. I need to know how Astrid died.
Elizabeth killed her.
How?
When Michael told him, he closed his eyes. They stood there, side by side, each clinging to the fence, as the first ferryman began to arrive for work. A few minutes later, the boat began to rumble in its slip.
It was never personal, Delaroche said finally. It was just business.
Do you understand what I'm saying to you, Michael? It was just business.
You put me and my family through hell, and I'll never forgive you for it.
But I understand. I understand everything now.
42. Shelter Island, New York. When they arrived at the gate of Cannon Point, a security officer named Tom Moore stepped out of the guard shack. He was a former Army Ranger with thick, square shoulders and short-cropped blonde hair.
Sorry I didn't call first to let you know I was coming, Tom.
No problem, Mr. Osborne, Moore said. We heard about the ambassador, sir. Obviously we're all pulling for him. I just hope they catch the bastards who did it. Radio said they vanished without a trace.
It appears so.
This is a friend of mine, Michael said, gesturing at Delaroche. He'll be staying a day or two.
Yes, sir.
Come up to the house for lunch, Tom. We need to talk.
I don't want anything to do with it, Adrian Carter said. Turn it over to counterintelligence. Jesus, give it to the goons at the Bureau for all I care, but just get rid of it, because it will destroy anyone who touches it.
Carter and Michael walked along the bulkhead overlooking the Sound, head down, hands in pockets, like a search party looking for the body. The morning was windless and cold, the water gunmetal gray. Carter was wearing the same bloated nylon parka that he had worn the afternoon in Central Park when he had asked Michael to come back to the agency. He was a reformed smoker, but halfway through the story he bummed one of Michael's cigarettes and devoured it.
She's the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Michael said. She controls counterintelligence.
And as for the Bureau, who the hell wants to involve them? This is our affair. The Bureau will only rub our noses in it.
Are you forgetting that Jack the Ripper up there is your only witness? Carter said, nodding at the house. You must admit he does have a bit of a credibility problem. Have you at least considered the possibility he's invented the whole thing to prevent you from arresting him?
He's not making it up.
How can you be so sure? This whole business about a secret order called the Society sounds like a bunch of bullshit to me.
Someone hired that man to come kill me last year because I was getting too close to the truth of the transatlantic affair. I told two people inside the agency about my suspicions. One was you and the other was Monica Tyler.
So what?
Why did Monica drive me from the agency in the first place last year? Why did she remove me from the October case 1 week before he tried to kill Douglas?
And there's something else. Delaroche said there was a meeting of the Society on Mykonos earlier this month. Monica was in Europe for a regional security conference. After the meeting, she took 2 days of personal time and dropped out of sight.
Jesus Christ, Michael, I was in Europe earlier this month, too.
I believe it, Adrian. And so do you.
They left the grounds of Cannon Point and walked along Shore Road on the edge of Deering Harbor.
If this becomes public, it will be disastrous for the agency.
I agree, Michael said. It would take years to recover from a blow like this. It would destroy the agency's reputation in Washington and around the world, for that matter.
So what do you do?
Present her with the evidence and shut her down before she can do any more damage. She has blood on her hands, but if we do this in public, the agency will be in ruins. The only way you'll ever dislodge Monica from the 7th floor is with dynamite. I'll walk up there with a briefcase full of the stuff if I have to.
Why the fuck did you involve me?
Because you're the only one I trust. You were my controller, Adrian. You'll always be my controller. They stopped on a bridge spanning the mouth of a tidal creek at the foot of Deering Harbor. Beyond the bridge lay a broad plain of marsh grass and bare trees. A small, lean man stood in front of an easel on the bridge, painting. He wore fingerless wool gloves and a threadbare fisherman's sweater several sizes too large for him.
"Lovely," Carter said, looking at the work. "You're very talented."
"Thank you," the painter said, his English heavily accented. Carter turned to Michael and said, "You can't be serious. Adrian Carter, I'd like you to meet Jean-Paul Delaroche. You may know him better as October." Tom Moore came up to the house at noon.
"You wanted to see me, Mr. Osborne?
Come in, Tom. There's fresh coffee in the kitchen."
Michael poured coffee, and they sat across from each other at the small table in the kitchen.
"What can I do for you, Mr. Osborne?"
"There's going to be a meeting here this evening that I need to record, audio and visual," Michael began.
"Can the surveillance cameras be repositioned?"
"Yes, sir," Moore said flatly.
"Can you record on their output?"
"Yes, sir."
Adrian Carter came into the room, followed by Delaroche.
"Do we have any audio equipment on the property?"
"No, sir. Your father-in-law wouldn't allow any microphones. He thought it would be an invasion of his privacy." Moore's big face broke into a pleasant smile.
"He barely tolerates the cameras. Before he left for London, I caught him trying to disconnect one."
"How long would it take to get microphones and a recording deck?"
Moore shrugged.
"A couple of hours at the most."
"Can you install them so they can't be seen?"
"The microphones are easy because they're relatively small. The cameras are the problem. They're normal security cameras, about the size of a shoebox."
Michael swore softly.
"I have an idea, though."
"Yeah?"
"The cameras have a fairly long lens on them. If you held the meeting in the living room, I could position cameras outside on the lawn and shoot through the windows."
Michael smiled and said, "You're good, Tom."
"I did some intelligence work while I was with the Rangers."
"You just have to make certain the curtains stay open."
"I can't guarantee that."
"Worst case scenario, you'll have the audio as a backup."
Delaroche said, "You have any guns besides that museum piece you're carrying?"
Moore had a Smith & Wesson 38 revolver.
"I like these museum pieces because they don't jam," Moore said, smacking his thick hand against the holster. "But I might be able to lay my hands on a couple of automatics."
"What kind?"
"Colt 45s.
No Glocks or Berettas?"
"Sorry," Moore said, face perplexed.
"A Colt or two would be fine," Carter said.
"Yes, sir," Moore said.
"Mind telling me what this is all about?"
"Not a chance."
Delaroche followed Michael up the stairs to the bedroom. Michael went to the closet, opened the door, and pulled down a small box from the top shelf. He opened the box and took out the Beretta.
"I believe you dropped this the last time you were here," Michael said, handing the gun to Delaroche.
Delaroche's scarred right hand wrapped around the grip, and his finger reflexively slipped inside the trigger guard. Something about the way Delaroche handled the weapon so effortlessly made Michael feel cold.
"Where did you get this?" Delaroche asked.
"I fished it out of the water off the end of the dock."
"Who restored it?"
"I did."
Delaroche looked up from the gun and stared at Michael quizzically.
"Why on earth would you do that?"
"I'm not sure. I guess I wanted a reminder of what it really looked like."
Delaroche still had a 9mm clip in his pocket. He slipped it into the weapon and pulled the slider, chambering the first round.
"If you like, I suppose you could fulfill the terms of your contract at this moment."
Delaroche handed the Beretta back to Michael. At 4 o'clock that afternoon, Michael entered Douglas's study and dialed Monica Tyler's office at headquarters.
Carter listened on another extension, his hand over the receiver. Monica's secretary said Director Tyler was in a senior staff meeting and couldn't be interrupted. Michael said it was an emergency and was passed on to Tweedledee or Tweedledum. Michael was never certain which was which. They kept him waiting the statutory 10 minutes while Monica was pulled from the meeting. "I know everything," Michael said when she finally came on the line. "I know about the society, and I know about the director. I know about Mitchell Elliott and the transatlantic affair. And I know you tried to have me killed."
"Michael, are you truly delusional? What on earth are you talking about?"
"I'm offering you a way out of this quietly."
"Michael, I don't come to my father-in-law's house on Shelter Island. Come alone. No security, no staff. Be here by 10 p.m. If you're not here by then, or if I see anything I don't like, I'll go to the Bureau and the New York Times and tell them everything I know."
He hung up without waiting for her answer. 30 minutes later, the secure telephone rang in the study of the director's London mansion. He was sitting in a wing chair next to the fire, feet propped on an ottoman, working his way through a stack of paperwork. Daphne slipped into the room and answered the phone.
"It's Picasso," Daphne said. "She says it's urgent."
The director took the receiver and said, "Yes, Picasso." Monica Tyler calmly told him about the call she had just received from Michael Osborne. "I suspect October is the source of his information," the director said. "If that's true, it would seem to me that Osborne has a rather weak case. October knows very little about the overall structure of our organization, and he is hardly a credible witness. He is a man who kills for money, a man without morality and without loyalty."
"I agree, Director, but I don't think we should simply dismiss the threat."
"I'm not suggesting that."
"Do you have the resources to eliminate them?"
"Not on such short notice."
"And if I simply arrest October?"
"Then he and Osborne will tell their story to the world."
"I'm open to suggestions."
"Do you know how to play poker?" the director asked.
"Figuratively or literally?"
"A little of both, actually."
"I believe I understand your point."
"Listen to what Osborne has to say, and evaluate your options. I know I don't need to remind you that you swore an oath of allegiance to the society. Your first concern is upholding that oath."
"I understand, Director."
"Perhaps you will be presented with an opportunity to resolve the matter yourself."
"I've never done that sort of thing, Director."
"It's not so difficult, Picasso. I wait to hear from you."
He hung up the telephone and looked at Daphne.
"Begin calling the members of the Executive Council and the Division Chiefs. I need to speak to each of them urgently. I'm afraid we may be forced to close down shop for a while."
Monica Tyler hung up the telephone and stared out her window at the Potomac. She walked across the room and stopped in front of a Rembrandt, a landscape she had purchased at auction in New York for a small fortune. Her eyes ran over the painting now, the clouds, the light spilling from the cottage, the horseless trap in the grass of the meadow. She took hold of the frame and pulled. The Rembrandt swung back on its hinges, revealing a small wall safe. Her fingers worked the tumblers automatically, eyes barely looking at the numbers. A few seconds later, the safe was open. She began removing items, an envelope containing $100,000 in cash, 3 false passports in different names from different countries, credit cards corresponding to the names. Then she removed one final item, a Browning automatic.
"Perhaps you will be presented with an opportunity to resolve the matter yourself."
She changed clothes, exchanging the tailored Chanel for a pair of jeans and a sweater. She placed the items from the safe into a large black leather handbag. Then she packed a small overnight bag with a change of clothes. She pulled the handbag over her shoulder and reached inside, wrapping her hand around the grip of the Browning. She had been trained by the agency to handle a gun. A member of her security detail was waiting outside in the hall.
Good afternoon, Director Tyler.
Good afternoon, Ted.
Back to headquarters, Director.
The helipad, actually.
The helipad? No one told us anything about
it. It's all right, Ted, she said calmly. It's a private matter.
The security man looked at her carefully. Is there something wrong, Director Tyler?
No, Ted. Everything's going to be just fine.
43. Shelter Island, New York. Michael maintained a tense vigil on the lawn of Cannon Point. He was drinking Adrian Carter's vile coffee and smoking his own vile cigarettes, pacing the frozen grass with a pair of Douglas's bird-watching binoculars around his neck. God, but it was a cold night, he thought. He looked once more at the western sky, the direction Monica would come, but there was only a spray of wet stars scattered over the black carpet of space, and a sliver of moon, white as exposed bone. Michael looked at his watch. 9:58 p.m. Monica's never on time, he thought. Monica will be 10 minutes late for her own funeral, Carter once cracked, while cooling his heels in Monica's dreary anteroom. Maybe she won't come, Michael thought, or maybe I just hope she won't. Maybe Adrian had been right. Maybe he should just forget about the whole thing, leave the agency for good this time, and stay on Shelter Island with Elizabeth and the children. And what? Live the rest of my life looking over my shoulder, waiting for Monica and her friends to send another assassin, another Delaroche? He checked the time once more. It was his father's old watch, German-made, big as a silver dollar, waterproof, dustproof, shockproof, childproof, faintly luminous. Perfect for a spy. It was the only one of his father's possessions Michael had taken after he died. He even kept the lousy expansion band that left a puckered brickwork pattern on the skin of his wrist. Sometimes he would look at the watch and think of his father in Moscow or Rome or Vienna or Beirut waiting for an agent. He wondered what his father would think of all this. He never told me what he was thinking then, Michael thought. Why should now be any different? He heard a thumping sound that could have been a distant helicopter, but it was only the nightclub across the water in Greenport, the house band gearing up for yet another dreadful set. Michael thought of his motley operational team, Delaroche, his enemy, his living proof of Monica's treachery, waiting to be wheeled onto the stage and wheeled off again. Tom Moore, parked in front of his monitors in the guest cottage, about to get the shock of his life. Adrian Carter, pacing behind him, chain-smoking Michael's cigarettes, wishing he were anywhere else. Michael heard the thump of the helicopter long before he could see it. For an instant he thought there might be two, or three, or even four. Instinctively he reached for the Colt automatic that Tom Moore had given him, but after a moment he saw the lights of a single helicopter approaching over Nassau Point and Great Hog Neck, and he realized it was only the night wind playing tricks on his ears. He thought of the morning 2 months earlier when the helicopter bearing President James Beckwith had made the same journey to Shelter Island, setting off the chain of events that had led him to this place. The images played out in his mind as the helicopter drew nearer. Adrian Carter on the levee of the reservoir in Central Park, seducing Michael into coming back. Kevin McGuire strapped to a chair and Seamus Devlin smiling over him. I didn't kill Kevin McGuire, Michael. You killed him. Preston McDaniels being crushed beneath the wheels of the Misery Line train. Delaroche smiling over the rail of Key Bridge. Do you know the story of the frog and the scorpion crossing the Nile? Sometimes intelligence work is like that, his father used to say, like chaos theory. A breath of wind disturbs the surface of a pond, moving a reed of grass, which sends a dragonfly to flight, which startles a frog, and so on, until 10,000 miles away and many weeks later a typhoon destroys an island in the Philippines. The helicopter swept low over Southold Bay. Michael looked at his father's wristwatch, 10:01. The helicopter descended over Shelter Island Sound and Deering Harbor, then set down on the broad lawn of Cannon Point. The engine shut down and the rotor gradually stopped twisting.
The door opened and a small staircase unfolded to the ground. Monica climbed out, a black bag over her shoulder, and marched resolutely toward the house. "Let's get this nonsense over with," she said, brushing past Michael. "I'm a very busy woman." Monica Tyler was not a pacer, but she was pacing now. She toured Douglas Cannon's living room like a politician inspecting a trailer park after a tornado, calm, stoic, empathetic, but careful not to step in anything foul. She paused from time to time, now frowning at the floral slipcover on the couch, now grimacing at the rustic throw rug in front of the fire. "You have cameras somewhere, don't you, Michael?" she said, making a statement rather than asking a question. "And microphones." She continued her restless journey around the room. "You don't mind if I close these curtains, do you, Michael? You see, I've been through that little course at the farm, too. I may not be an experienced field man like you, but I know a little something about the clandestine arts." She made a vast show of closing the curtains. "There," she said, "that's much better." She sat down, a reluctant, arrogant witness taking her place in the dock. The log fire began to spit. She crossed one leg over the other, resting her long hands on the faded denim of her jeans, and settled a frozen gaze on Michael. The prosaic surroundings had stolen her physical intimidation. There was no gold pen to wield like a stiletto, no glossy secretary to interrupt a meeting that had unexpectedly turned unpleasant, no Tweedledum and Tweedledee watchful as Dobermans clutching their leather folders and secure cell phones. Delaroche entered the room. He was smoking a cigarette. Monica glared at him with disdain, for tobacco, like personal disloyalty, was among her many pet peeves. "This man is called Jean-Paul Delaroche," Michael said. "Do you know who he is?" "I suspect he is a former KGB assassin codenamed October, who now works as an international contract killer." "Do you know why he's here?" "Probably because he nearly killed your father-in-law last night in Georgetown, despite our best efforts to stop him." "What game are you playing, Monica?" Michael asked sharply. "I was about to ask you the same question." "I know everything," he said, calmer now. "Believe me, Michael, you don't know everything. In fact, you know next to nothing. You see, your little escapade has severely jeopardized one of the most important operations currently being conducted by the Central Intelligence Agency." The room had gone silent, except for the fire, which was spitting again, crackling like small arms. Outside, the wind was moving the leafless trees, and one was scratching against the side of the house. A truck grumbled along Shore Road, and somewhere a dog was barking. "If you want the rest, you have to shut down your microphones," Monica said. Michael remained motionless. Monica reached for her handbag as if getting up to leave. "All right," Michael said. He stood, walked to Douglas's desk, and opened a drawer. Inside was a microphone about the size of a finger. Michael held it up for Monica to see. "Disconnect it," she said. He pulled the microphone from its cable. "Now the backup," she said. "You're too paranoid to do something like this without a backup." Michael walked to the bookshelves, removed a volume of Proust, and pulled out the second microphone. "Kill it," Monica said. Delaroche looked at Michael. "She has a gun in the handbag." Michael walked over to the chair where Monica Tyler was seated, reached inside the bag, and pulled out the Browning. "Since when do CIA directors carry weapons?" "When they feel threatened," Monica said. Michael set the safety and tossed the Browning to Delaroche. "All right, Monica, let's get started." Adrian Carter was a worrier by nature, a personality trait somehow at odds with the job of sending agents into the field and waiting for them to come out again. He had endured many tense vigils concerning Michael Osborne over the years. He remembered the two endless nights he had spent in Beirut in 1985, waiting for Michael to return from a meeting with an agent in the Bekaa Valley. Carter had feared Michael had been taken hostage or killed. He was about to give up when Michael stumbled into Beirut,
covered in dust and smelling of goats. Still, nothing compared to the uneasiness Carter felt now, as he listened to his agent confronting the Director of Central Intelligence. When she demanded that Michael disable the first microphone, Carter was not terribly worried. There were two in the room, and an experienced field man like Michael would never give up his ace in the hole. Then he heard Monica demand disconnection of the second, followed by thumping and scratching as Michael dug it from the bookshelf. When the feed from the room fell silent, he did the only thing a good agent runner can do. He lit another of Michael's cigarettes, and he waited. A short time after I was appointed DCI, I was approached by a man who referred to himself only as the Director. She spoke like an exhausted mother, reluctantly telling a fairy tale to a child who refuses to go to bed. He asked me if I would be willing to join an elite club, a group of international intelligence officers, financiers, and businessmen dedicated to the preservation of global security. I suspected something was amiss, so I reported the incident to counterintelligence as a potential recruitment by a hostile organization. CI thought it might be operationally productive if we danced with the Director, and I agreed. I sought approval from the President himself to begin the operation. I met with a man called the Director three more times, twice in Northern Europe and once in the Mediterranean. At the end of the third meeting, we came to terms, and I joined the Society. The Society has very long tentacles. It is involved in covert operations on a global scale. I immediately began collecting intelligence on membership and operations. Some intelligence was laundered through the agency, and we took countermeasures. Sometimes we deemed it was necessary to allow Society operations to continue, because disrupting them could jeopardize my position inside the hierarchy of the organization. Michael watched her as she spoke. She was calm and collected and utterly lucid, as though she were reading a prepared speech to a gathering of shareholders. He was in awe of her. She was a remarkable liar. "Who's the Director?" Michael asked. "I don't know. And I suspect Delaroche doesn't know either." "Did you know he had been hired to kill my father-in-law?" "Of course, Michael," she said, narrowing her eyes scornfully. "Then what was that song and dance in the executive dining room about? Why did you remove me from the case?" "Because the Director asked me to," she said flatly. Then added, "Let me explain. He thought it would be easier for Delaroche to carry out the assignment if you were no longer in charge of the case. So I removed you and quietly took steps to ensure your father-in-law's safety. Unfortunately, those steps were not successful."
"If that was the case, why wasn't he provided additional protection in Washington?"
"Because the Director assured me that Delaroche would not operate on American soil."
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"Because we didn't want you to do anything rash that might jeopardize the security of the operation. The goal was to draw Delaroche into the open so he could be eliminated, taken off the market, as it were. We didn't want you to frighten him away by locking your father-in-law inside a vault and throwing away the key."
Michael looked at Delaroche, who was shaking his head. "She's lying," he said. "The Director arranged everything for me here, transportation, weapons, everything. He specifically decided to carry out the assassination in Washington because he knew the ambassador would be more vulnerable here than in London. It was time to coincide with the Northern Ireland Conference to increase the impact on the peace process." He paused a moment, eyes moving from Michael to Monica and back again. "She's very good, but she's lying."
Monica ignored him, looking at Michael. "This is why we didn't want Delaroche to be taken into custody, Michael, because he would lie, because he would fabricate. He would say anything to save his own skin." Her gaze moved from Delaroche to Michael, "and the problem is you believe him. We wanted him eliminated because if he was arrested, we suspected he might pull a stunt like this."
"It's not a stunt," Delaroche said. "It's the truth."
"You should have played your part better, Michael. You should have just taken your revenge for Sarah Randolph and killed him. But now you've created quite a mess, for the agency and for yourself."
Monica stood up, signaling that the meeting had come to an end. Michael said, "If you insist on playing it this way,
You leave me no other choice but to go to counterintelligence and the Bureau with my suspicions about you. You'll spend the next 2 years going through the agency equivalent of Chinese water torture. Then the Senate will want a piece of you. Your legal bills alone will bankrupt you. You'll never work in government again, and no one on Wall Street will touch you with a barge pole. You'll be destroyed, Monica. You don't have enough proof, and no one will believe you. The son-in-law of Ambassador Douglas Cannon alleges that the director of the Central Intelligence Agency was involved in the attempt to assassinate him. That's a hell of a story. There's not a reporter in Washington who wouldn't jump all over it. And you'll be prosecuted for leaking agency secrets. I'll take my chances. Adrian Carter stepped into the room. Monica looked at him, then her eyes settled back on Michael. A witch hunt will destroy the agency, Michael. You should know that. Your father was caught up in the Angleton mole hunt, wasn't he? It almost ruined his career. Is this your way of taking revenge on the agency for your father? Or are you still resentful of me because I had the gall to suspend you once? You're not in any position to piss me off right now, Monica. So what do I have to do to prevent you from making this reckless allegation against me? You're going to resign at the appropriate time. And until then, you're going to do exactly as Adrian and I say. And you're going to help me put the society out of business. God, but you're a naive fool. Putting the society out of business is impossible. The only way to control them is to be part of them. She looked at Delaroche. What do you plan to do with him? Michael said, I'll handle Delaroche. He reached into his coat pocket and withdrew a cassette tape. I made this today, along with a few duplicates, he said. It contains a full accounting of your role in the society, the transatlantic affair, and the attempt to kill my father-in-law. I'm going to set up a tripwire. If any harm comes to Adrian, Delaroche, or me, copies of this tape will be sent to the New York Times and the FBI. Michael placed the tape back in his pocket. It's your move, Monica. I've given 6 years of my life to the agency, she said. I've done everything in my power to ensure its survival and to protect it from men like you, dinosaurs who lack the vision to see that the agency has a role in this new world of ours. The game has passed you by, Michael, and you're too stupid to even notice. You've used the agency as a personal plaything to advance your own interests, and now I'm taking it back. She pulled her bag over her shoulder, turned, and walked out. It's your move, Monica, Michael repeated, but she simply kept walking. A moment later, they heard the whine of the helicopter engine coming to life again. Michael stepped onto the veranda in time to see Monica's chopper lift from the lawn and disappear over the waters of the Sound. They spent the next day waiting. Carter stood on the veranda, field glasses around his neck, staring toward the Sound like a border guard on the Berlin Wall. Michael circled the house, marching along stony beaches and through the woods, searching for signs of an enemy buildup. All the while, Delaroche just watched them, a slightly bemused bystander to the wreck he had caused. Carter stayed in touch with headquarters. Has anyone heard from Monica? He would ask innocently at the conclusion of each conversation. The answers grew more intriguing as the day progressed. Monica's canceled all meetings. Monica's holed up in her office. Monica's not taking calls. Monica's gone underground. Monica's refusing food and drink. Michael and Carter debated the significance of the reports, as spies are prone to do. Was she drawing up the terms of surrender, or preparing a counterattack? In the afternoon, Carter went into the village for food. Delaroche cooked omelets for them, propped on a stool because he couldn't stand long on his swollen ankle. They drank one bottle of wine, then another. Delaroche provided the entertainment. For 2 hours he lectured, training, tradecraft, assignments, cover identities, weaponry, and tactics. He told them nothing they could ever use against him, but he seemed to take pleasure from even the slightest unburdening of secrets. He said nothing of Sarah Randolph or Astrid Vogel or the night a year earlier at Cannon Point when he and Michael had shot each other.
He remained very still as he spoke, hands folded on the table, left hand covering the right in order to hide the puckered scar that had led Michael to him. Carter asked the questions because Michael was already somewhere else. Oh, he was listening, Carter thought. Michael, the human dictaphone, capable of monitoring 3 conversations and reciting each of them back to you a week later, but a corner of his mind was turning over another problem. Finally, Carter switched to Russian, a language Michael did not speak well, and the 2 men finished their conversation in private. At dusk, Michael and Delaroche walked. Michael, the former track star, had wrapped Delaroche's ankle in heavy white tape. Carter remained behind in the house. It would be like eavesdropping on quarreling lovers, and he wanted no part of it. Still, he could not resist the urge to step onto the veranda and watch them. He was not a voyeur, just a control officer, looking out for his agent and old friend. They walked along the bulkhead toward the dock, Delaroche limping slightly. As the light grew weaker, Carter could not tell one from the other, so similar were the 2 men in height and build. He realized then that in many ways they were 2 halves of the same man. Each possessed traits present but successfully repressed in the other. If not for birthright, the haphazard roulette wheel of time and place, each might very well have walked the opposite path. Jean-Paul Delaroche, virtuous intelligence officer. Michael Osborne, assassin. After a long time, an hour, Carter guessed, because uncharacteristically he had neglected to record the time the conversation began, Michael and Delaroche started back toward the house. They paused at Michael's rental car and faced each other over the hood. Carter still could not tell which was which. One seemed to be speaking with intensity, the other lazily kicking at the ground with the toe of his shoe. When the conversation ended, the one who had been kicking the ground held out his hand over the hood of the car, but the other refused to take it. Delaroche withdrew his hand and climbed into the car. He drove through the security gate and sped into the darkness along Shore Road. Michael Osborne walked slowly up to the house. 44. Washington, Vienna, South Island, New Zealand. Ambassador Douglas Cannon was released from George Washington University Hospital on an unusually hot morning in the second week of April. Overnight it had rained, but by mid-morning the puddles were blazing beneath a fierce sunlight. Only a small company of reporters and cameramen waited outside in the drive, for Washington's media suffer from a sort of collective attention deficit syndrome, and no one was really interested in watching an old man leaving the hospital. Still, Douglas managed to make news, as they say in the trade, when he loudly demanded to walk rather than ride out in the obligatory wheelchair. So loudly, in fact, that he could be heard by the reporters outside. "I was shot in the back, goddammit, not the legs," Cannon rumbled. His remarks were reported that night on the evening news, much to the ambassador's delight. He stayed at the house on N Street in Georgetown for the first 2 weeks of his recovery, then went home to his beloved Cannon Point. A small crowd of well-wishers waved and shouted as Douglas's car passed through Shelter Island Heights. He remained at Cannon Point for the rest of the spring. The security guards accompanied him as he walked the stony tide line of Upper Beach and the footpaths of Mashamack Preserve. By June, he felt strong enough to go for a sail aboard Athena. Uncharacteristically, he surrendered the helm to Michael, but he barked orders and criticized his son-in-law's seamanship so forcefully that Michael threatened to throw him overboard off Plum Island. Old friends urged Douglas to resign his post in London. Even President Beckwith thought it would be best. But at the end of June, he returned to London and settled into his office at Grosvenor Square. On July 4, Independence Day, he made a special appearance before Parliament, then traveled to Belfast, where he received a hero's welcome. To coincide with his visit, the British and American intelligence and security services released the findings of their joint investigation into the Ulster Freedom Brigade's attempt to kill Cannon in Washington.
The report concluded that there were two terrorists involved, a woman named Rebecca Wells, who was also involved in the Hartley Hall affair, and an unidentified man who apparently was a professional assassin hired by the group. Despite a worldwide search, both terrorists remained at large. Within hours of Cannon's visit to Northern Ireland, a large car bomb exploded outside a market near the corner of the White Rock Road and the Falls Road. 5 people died and another 16 were injured. The Ulster Freedom Brigade claimed responsibility. That night, a fringe Republican group calling itself the Irish Liberation Cell avenged the attack by setting off a massive truck bomb that flattened much of central Portadown. The group promised to continue its attacks until the Good Friday Peace Accords were dead. For many weeks, the endless corridors at Langley crackled with rumors of a shake-up on the 7th floor. Monica was leaving, according to one rumor. She was staying forever, according to another. Monica had fallen out of favor with the president. Monica was about to become Secretary of State. The most popular rumor among her detractors was the story that she had suffered a nervous breakdown, that she had become delusional, that in a fit of psychotic rage, she had tried to smash her precious mahogany office furniture to splinters. Inevitably, the pervasive rumors about Monica reached the ears of the Washington Post. The newspaper's intelligence correspondent chose to discard the more salacious things he had heard, but in a lengthy front-page piece, he did report that Monica had lost the confidence of the agency's rank and file, the barons of the intelligence community, and even the president himself. That afternoon, during a photo opportunity with school children in the Rose Garden, President Beckwith said that Monica Tyler retained his full and complete confidence. Translated from Washington speak into plain English, the remark meant that Monica Tyler was being measured for the drop. She was besieged with interview requests. Meet the Press wanted her. Ted Koppel telephoned personally to invite her on Nightline. A booker from the staff of Larry King Live actually tried to talk her way past the guards at the front gate. Monica turned them all away. Instead, she released a written statement saying that she served at the pleasure of the president, and if the president wanted her to remain, she would. But the damage was already done. Winter descended on the 7th floor. Doors remained tightly closed. Papers stopped flowing. Paralysis was setting in. Monica was cut off, said the rumor mill. Monica was less accessible than ever. Monica was finished. Tweedledee and Tweedledum were rarely seen. When they did appear, they moved about the halls like skittish gray wolves. Something had to be done, said the rumors. Things couldn't go on this way. Finally, in July, Monica summoned the staff to the auditorium and announced that she was resigning effective September 1. She was making the announcement early so that President Beckwith, whom she admired deeply and had been honored to serve, would have ample time to choose a suitable successor. In the meantime, there would be changes in the senior staff. Adrian Carter would be the new executive director. Cynthia Martin would take Carter's place as chief of the counterterrorism center, and Michael Osborne would be the new deputy director for operations. In the autumn, Monica dropped from sight. Her old firm wanted her back, but Monica said she needed some time to herself before returning to the grind of Wall Street. She began to travel. Reports of her whereabouts regularly reached Carter and Michael on the 7th floor at Langley. Monica was always alone, according to watch reports. No friends, no family, no lovers, no dogs, no suspicious contacts of any kind. She had been seen in Buenos Aires. She had been spotted in Paris. She had gone on safari in South Africa. She went scuba diving in the Red Sea, much to the surprise of everyone at headquarters, since no one there had ever unearthed the fact that she was an expert diver. In late November, a surveillance artist from the CIA's Vienna station photographed Monica seated alone in a chilly cafe in Stephansplatz. That same night, Monica Tyler was walking back to her hotel after dinner, through a narrow pedestrian passageway in the shadow of St. Stephen's Cathedral, when a man appeared before her. He was average in height, compact in build, and light on his feet. Something about the way he moved, the determined rhythm of his gait, set off alarm bells in her head.
Monica glanced over her shoulder and realized she was alone. She stopped walking, turned around, and started back toward the square. The man, now behind her, only quickened his pace. Monica did not run. She realized it would be pointless. She just closed her eyes and kept walking. The man drew closer, but nothing happened. She stopped and spun around to challenge him. As she turned, the man removed a gun from the inside of his jacket. A long, slender silencer was fitted into the end of the barrel. "Dear God, no," she said. But the man's arm swung up, and he fired rapidly 3 times. Monica Tyler fell backward, staring up at the spires of the cathedral. She listened to the sound of her killer walking away, felt her own blood leaking from her body onto the cold cobblestones. Then the spires of St. Stephen's turned to water, and she died. In Georgetown, Elizabeth Osborne heard the telephone ringing. Now that Michael was the deputy director, phone calls at 4 in the morning were not uncommon. She had an important meeting with a client in the morning. She had transferred to the firm's Washington office when Michael was promoted, and she needed to sleep. She closed her eyes and tried not to listen to Michael murmuring in the dark. "Anything important?" she asked when she heard him replace the receiver. "Monica Tyler was murdered tonight in Vienna."
"Murdered? What happened?"
"She was shot to death."
"Who would want to kill Monica Tyler?"
"Monica had a lot of enemies."
"Are you going in?"
"No," he said. "I'll deal with it in the morning." She closed her eyes and tried to sleep. But it was no good. There was something in Michael's voice that disturbed her. "Monica had a lot of enemies. Including you, Michael," she thought. Sometime before dawn, he left their bed. Elizabeth got up and went downstairs. She found him in the living room, standing before the French doors, staring into the half-lit garden.
"Michael," she said softly, "are you all right?"
"I'm fine," he said, without turning around.
"Is there something you want to talk about?"
"No, Elizabeth," he said. "I just needed to think."
"Michael, if there's..."
"I said I can't talk about it, Elizabeth. So please, drop it." He turned away from the French doors and walked past her without speaking. Elizabeth saw that his face was the color of ash. The Society for International Development and Cooperation convened its annual summer conference in a lakeside chateau high in the mountains of New Zealand's South Island. The site had been chosen long in advance, and the frozen lake and dense fogs of the New Zealand winter proved a befitting allegory for the Society's dreadful state following Picasso's demise. The director's background at MI6 had prepared him for the occasional blown operation, but nothing at the intelligence service could compare with the global folding of the tents that occurred in the hours after Picasso's unveiling. Overnight, all operations ceased. Plans for new undertakings were quietly scrapped. Communication fell silent. Money stopped flowing. The director sealed himself in his mansion in St. John's Wood with only Daphne for company and did what any good operations man does after a right royal cock-up. He assessed the damage. And when he felt the time was right, he quietly set about stitching together the scattered remnants of his secret order. The conference on South Island was supposed to be a sort of coming-out party. But the Society's rehabilitation was halting at best. 2 members of the executive committee did not even bother to attend. 1 tried to send a proxy, a suggestion the director found laughable. Shortly after convening the meeting, the director, in a rare fit of pique, moved to expel them both. The motion passed on a voice vote, which Daphne dutifully recorded on her stenopad. "Item number 2 on the agenda is the passing of Picasso," the director said, then gently cleared his throat. "Her death came as a terrible shock to you all, I'm sure.
but at least she's no longer in a position to do the society any harm.
I congratulate you for dealing with the problem so professionally, said Rodin.
But you don't understand, the director said. Her death truly did come as a shock, because the society had absolutely nothing to do with it.
But what about October? He is still alive, is he not?
I would assume that to be the case. I'm not certain. Perhaps the CIA has hidden him. Perhaps Michael Osborne killed him and covered it up. The only thing I can say for certain is that all our attempts to locate him have failed.
Perhaps I could be of assistance, said Monet, the chief of operations for Israel's Mossad. Our men have proved themselves capable of finding fugitives in the past. Finding a man like October shouldn't prove too terribly difficult.
But the director slowly shook his head.
No, he said. Even if October is still alive, I doubt he'll ever be a problem to us in the future. In my opinion, it's best to let the matter drop.
The director looked down and shuffled his papers.
Which brings me to the third item on our agenda, the situation in the former Yugoslavia. A Kosovo Liberation Front would like our help. Gentlemen, we're back in business.
Epilogue. Lisbon, Brel, France. Jean-Paul Delaroche had taken a small flat in a sagging amber apartment house overlooking the harbor in Lisbon. He had been to Lisbon just once, and only briefly, and the change in setting gave new life to his work. Indeed, he experienced his most productive period in many years. He worked diligently from morning until mid-afternoon, producing fine works of the churches and the squares and the boats along the waterfront. The owner of an eminent Lisbon gallery saw him painting one afternoon and enthusiastically offered to show his work. Delaroche accepted his card with his paint-smudged fingers and said he would think about it. At night, he went hunting. He stood on his balcony and looked for signs of surveillance. He walked for hours, trying to draw them into the open. He went cycling in the countryside and dared them to follow. He bugged his own flat to see if anyone was entering when he was away. On the last day of November, he accepted the fact that he was not being watched. That evening he left his flat and walked to a good café for dinner. For the first time in 30 years, he left his gun behind. In December, he rented a Fiat sedan and drove to France. He had left Brel, the old fishing village on the Breton coast, more than a year ago, and had not set foot there since. He arrived at midday, the day after setting out from Lisbon, having spent one night in Biarritz. He parked in town and went walking. No one recognized him. At the boulangerie, Mademoiselle Trévance handed him his bread with barely a bonjour. Mademoiselle Plochet from the charcuterie used to flirt with him shamelessly. Now she joylessly carved his ham and his wedge of goat cheese and sent him on his way. Delaroche went to the café where the old men passed afternoons. He asked if any of them had seen an Irish woman around the village. Black hair, good hips, pretty.
There is an Irish woman living in the old cottage on the point, said Didier, the crimson-faced owner of the general store, where the madman used to live, Le Solitaire.
When Delaroche pretended not to know what he meant by the last remark, Didier just laughed and gave Delaroche directions to the cottage. Then he asked if Delaroche wanted to join them for some wine and olives. Delaroche just shook his head and said, non, merci. Delaroche drove along the coast road and parked about 200 yards from the cottage in a turnout overlooking the water. He saw smoke rising from the chimney only to be sliced away by the wind. He just sat there, picking at the bread and the cheese, smoking, watching the cottage and the waves beating against the rocks. Once he caught a glimpse of her raven hair passing before an open window. He thought of the last thing Michael Osborne had said to him that night before they parted on Shelter Island. She deserves worse, he had said. She deserves to die.
Osborne was too decent a man, too virtuous, to condemn Monica to death. But Delaroche believed he knew what was in Osborne's heart at that moment. It was a small price to repay Osborne for giving him his freedom. Actually, he rather enjoyed it. She was one of the most offensive people he had ever met. And there was one more thing. She had seen his face. Rebecca stepped onto the terrace, arms folded beneath her breasts, gazing at the setting sun. Delaroche thought, "Does she want to see me? Or does she want me to stay away so she can put the entire business behind her? The easiest thing would be to turn around and forget about her, go back to Lisbon and his work, take up the gallery owner on his offer to show the paintings." He started the engine. Even the distant sound made her turn suddenly and reach beneath her sweater. It was the hiding, Delaroche thought. She's jumping at noises, reaching for guns. He knew the feeling too well. Rebecca stared at the car for a long time, and after a while her mouth lifted into something like a smile. Then she turned away and looked out to sea again, and waited for him to come to her. Delaroche dropped the car into gear and started down the road toward the cottage.
The End. You've been listening to The Marching Season by Daniel Silva, narrated by Frank Muller. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Payback by Thomas Kelly, narrated by Ron McClarty, and Finding Moon by Tony Hillerman, narrated by George Guidel. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Recorded Book or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.